This Saturday, I was at Red Morton Park, which is a park in the middle of Redwood City. It's a kind of a biggish park, with my 2.5-year-old son. And I was also there with my 7-year-old son because it was the opening day of Little League baseball season. So it was kind of the opening event. And now it kept my 2.5-year-old son's interest for about 20 minutes. And at some point he was no longer interested in being there. And so he started walking away. And I had a different idea of what he was supposed to do. And it became a little bit, you know, my idea versus his idea. And he was determined to walk out. And there's a lot of strategies of how to work with a 2.5-year-old who has a will of his own. And I don't really know those strategies very well. And I thought, well, this is interesting. So I'll just try letting him go. And if he gets, you know, 30, 40, 50 feet away, at some point he'll realize that he's alone. And he'll get frightened or something, and he'll come back to me. So it's kind of a game of chicken, right? To see who's going to blink first. And he started walking 20, 30, 50 feet, you know, and he wasn't blinking. He just kept going and going and going. And it's a very large, the field where we were at was quite large, a very large field. And I was kind of at one edge with all the people, and he was way off the other edge. And I could see him quite well. I could see what was going on, and I was watching him there. And he wasn't in any danger or anything, but he was just walking down the path. You know, I don't know where he was going, but he was heading out. And there was really no one there. And then at some point, this woman ran by. She was jogging. And she ran down the path, and she saw this 2.5-year-old small guy kind of going around. And she looked down, she passed her like this, and then she looked around, you know, something's not right here. You know, and I could see her, she kept running, but kind of looking, where are the parents? Where is someone, you know? And she didn't know that I was kind of, you know, tracking the situation. And then I saw her, she kept running, but she went, I don't know, maybe another 100 yards or so, and there was a man sitting there. And she stopped and started asking him questions, you know, just pointing back, you know. I couldn't know what they said, but I can imagine, you know, what's going on here? And you with that boy, or, you know. And so at that point, I blinked. And so then I went off to find him and go get him and bring him back or do something with him. But I was so touched by this woman going by. This strong instinct, is that what it is? Strong feeling, strong impulse she had seeing an unintended small child and being concerned about that as if it was her own business to take care of and do something about and to stop and inquire and see what's going on here and look into that. What is that instinct? What is that impulse to care for a young child? So my 7-year-old also this on Friday, he hurt his finger. Not so seriously, but seriously enough that my wife took him to the emergency to have it x-rayed and checked. And he had one of those kind of injuries that I think half of you are in the crowd here. Well, if I tell you what it is, you'll probably kind of like cringe, like chalkboard. So they need to tell me, you know, what's your reaction when I tell you what happened to him with his finger? He got it jammed in the car door. See? What a response, huh? And so he went to the doctor, and it's not broken or anything, but the doctor thought he should wear. The doctor calls it a froggy. I don't know, this little kind of, is that what it's called? Now it's called a froggy, in our house at least. It's this little metal kind of splinter you wear on your finger so you don't bend it. And some point on Saturday or Sunday, my son was playing around or something, and he didn't hurt it again. He did, but it was like almost like he hit it, or almost like kind of got hit by something, and it, before thinking, before any cognitive recognition was going on, I could feel my body kind of go, you know, I could almost feel his pain, you know, the potential pain in that finger almost getting hit again and hurting. So human beings have a capacity of empathy, of feeling each other, being concerned with each other, caring for each other. That is a pretty deep impulse in, I think, most everyone. I think that we often tune in. Part of our being tunes in to the emotional environment around us, to the emotions of other people, and we relate to that. We tune into that. Researchers have pointed out that even when people are not cognitively thinking that they're tuning into the emotions around them, their facial, if they kind of map very carefully the facial expressions of people, they see that their facial expressions are changing slightly in relationship to the people who they're with. If the person they're with gets sad, the faces changes a little bit. And this evening, before coming here, I was reading a Dr. Seuss book to the 2.5-year-old. And there's a book called If I Had a Zoo. No, it's a different story. You know, Horton and the Who. Horton, this is elephant, partway through the book, gets really sad. And there's two pages with him, this really sad face. And then the third page, he finds what he's looking for and he's really happy. We've gone over and over these three pages. You know, I don't know, I can tell you how many times. He's just fascinated with these pages. This evening I watched his face and his expression. And when he saw the sad Horton, you could see this poor kid, you know. And I said, you know, what's happening here? And my son would say, oh, he's sad. You know, and his face would drop and just his energy would drop. And I didn't feel sad looking at the pictures, Dr. Seuss picture, but when I looked at my son reacting to that picture, it's like, whew, this is serious stuff here. And then I quickly turned to the other page, you know, and then my son would just beam up, you know, just tremendous light beam, you know, and I'd feel really happy just seeing my son being so happy, you know. And so he was sensitive enough to the pictures, the cartoons, and I was sensitive to his reaction. It's been said by some researchers that I don't have any basis to understanding the evidence, but that some of our emotional reactions and responses to people and situations is precognitive. That some of it certainly is cognitive. We have to kind of go through and think about things first and pass them through the filter of our thoughts, our memories, and ideas. But some of the things, certain kinds of emotions seem to have a certain precognitive aspect where before there's recognition, before there's thinking about it, before there's concepts around something, that somehow the nervous system or the bodily system will intuit or pick up or react or relate emotionally to what's happening. And in particular, what researchers have pointed out is that the caring emotions are this way, emotions of compassion, of caring, seem to have this kind of effect on people, that it seems to be quite innate, quite deep. In Buddhism often, especially in Mahayana Buddhism, there's a great teachings about emptiness. And emptiness is and the realization, the experience of emptiness is very important. And it's said in the tradition that the experience of emptiness in its most pristine forms comes with compassion. Or when the mind is most empty, the mind is most clear, when the mind is not filled with or has concepts or ideas in it, thoughts in it, that mind which is deeply at peace, empty in a sense, that has compassion in that there. That somehow there's a it doesn't even have to have compassion for anything in particular. There's compassion in that place. So the abandonment or the letting go of all the concepts we hold on to, all the ideas of who I am and who other people are, what I need, what I want, in relaxing all those, which is a huge leap sometimes people learn to do, that one of the benefits of that is coming to a place of caring, of compassion. And I believe that's one of the meanings of the Tibetan mantra, or it's in Sanskrit, but used in Tibetan Buddhism a lot, Om Mani Padme Om. Mani means jewel, and it's in the locative, means anyway, so Om Mani Padme Om, and Padme means lotus. And Om, in the beginning, is just kind of like, you know, great. And it doesn't mean anything, it's just a mantra. And Om at the end is a mantra, like hallelujah. But Mani Padme means the jewel in the lotus. So it's like hail, the jewel and lotus, hallelujah. And jewel and lotus, refers to the enlightened mind or the enlightened heart. And the jewel is that jewel which is found within the enlightened heart, within the freed or the awakened heart. And that jewel is compassion. So the heart of awakening is this wonderful jewel of compassion, of caring. In most, it's been pointed out, I haven't done the survey myself, but it's been pointed out that a lot of different religions have something or other that's similar to what's called the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. In Buddhism, there's a few different places where it says that, something like that, but one I could find this evening was, everyone trembles at violence. Everyone fears death. Seeing others as being like yourself, do not kill or cause others to kill. Seeing others as being like yourself. So here's an act of imagination of seeing others as if they're yourself, being in your shoes in a sense, or imagining them in your shoes. So what was it like? If you were in their shoes, how would you experience something? Or if they were you, and they were experiencing certain difficulties in life, what would it be like? So it's kind of the movement of empathy is in part a movement of imagination. And in part, it's something which is pre-imagination, pre-cognitive. It's both. They enhance each other. So the idea of imagining yourself as other, doing unto others as you'd want them to do unto you, In the Mahabharata, so in Hinduism, it says, do nothing to others which would cause you pain if done to you. Or Confucius, what I don't wish people to do to me, I also do not wish to do to them. And Muhammad, no one is a believer until he or she desires for others that which he or she desires for herself. And Jesus, whatever you want others to do for you, do unto others. And then there's George Bernard Shaw. Don't do unto others as you would want them to do to you. They may have different tastes. It's been said in Buddhism that that one of the primary foundations for Buddhist ethics is this kind of empathy, this kind of placing oneself in someone else's shoes, imagining self as other, other as self. And it's quite remarkable how much what happens when we really sense and feel and understand someone else's situation. When we don't not only imagine what it was like, not only imagine what it would be like for you to have that experience, which is it keeps you a little bit removed from what it is like for that person to have that experience. Because that person has a different history, different dispositions, different capacities, different all kinds of things than you have. So for them to kind of break their finger might have a very different meaning than for you to break your finger or whatever. So the act of imagination, to imagine what it's like if you were completely in that person's situation experiencing it. What's that like? Some of you perhaps may be new here today. Some of you have been here for a while and know a few people here in the group. But if we took 10 minutes, and we're not going to do it, so don't worry. But if we took 10 minutes and formed little groups of, say, 3 or 4 or 5 or something, and spent a little time, everyone saying a little bit about the struggles they or their family are having right now, their extended family or whatever, we would find that our hearts would start opening up very quickly to people who maybe were strangers to begin with. In 10 minutes, we can kind of get a very quick, heartfelt connection just hearing about the challenges and struggles people are having with family members who are sick or in hospital or dying or, relatives or neighbors or someone, or, you know, different things we're struggling with, drugs and alcohol and work and being fired and going to jail and, you know, all kinds of exciting things that I know, some of those things I know are happening here. And it would change the tenor of how we the sense of how we are with everyone here. Some people, when they hear, we're going to do this exercise now and find out who's here and what's going on, some people get shy, some people don't want to. And it can be very, very quick, a kind of defensiveness arises, a kind of resistance to getting to know someone else. And it's seen most clearly, where people often mention it, in going down the street and someone's homeless. You know, some people put up their guard, oh no. You know, they read about the Pope and how wonderful he was and how passionate he was and are so inspired by what he's done to the world and how he helped the poor and all that. And they go, wow, that's how to be. And then you go out onto the street and you see this homeless person and not that one. You know, and the guards go up. There's often fear. If I get to know someone or if I let them in, that then I'll be pulled into a whole world I don't want to be part of, or expectations or will be on me and be difficult to extract myself from it. So one of the foundations of Buddhist ethics is empathy. And it's an interesting foundation because it's not rule-based. It's not some commandment that comes down from above, but rather it's based on a sensibility that we can have, a sense we can have of what's going on around us, a sense of the impact things have on people, not wanting to cause harm because we can feel what that harm causes for them. There are times in our life when that sensitivity can become stronger, and sometimes when it can get weaker. If we're harried and busy or self-absorbed, it's very hard to have the sensitivity to the people around us, the impact life is having on them, their emotional things, what's going on. And there are sometimes when, for various reasons, we might be hypersensitive. And some people fall, naturally in a range of sensitivity. There was a time in my life where I remember once someone pulled a leaf off a tree and I felt pain. I'm not going to try to explain why or what was going on, but I remember I felt this tremendous pain. How could they do that? It was a time in my life where I had spent basically 3 months more or less on retreat and had a very, very deep sensitivity and very great openness to life. And it's just pulling off a leaf was something that caused me, how could they do that? I couldn't imagine pulling a leaf off a tree. Now I pull leaves off trees. So I've gone downhill a little bit from there. But I had that tremendous sensitivity. Sensitivity, ethical sensitivity, or sensitivity to empathy, or being connected to others, is partly connected to feeling unthreatened and feeling relaxed. If we feel threatened, it's hard to have empathy, hard to have feelings or be connected to someone else. And if we feel relaxed, if we're not feeling relaxed, it's also hard. But to be relaxed and unthreatened. Meditation practice, one of the things it's trying to do for us is help us be more relaxed. As we become more relaxed, we become more sensitive. Also, a meditation practice is trying to help us find a place of being, a healthy place, an appropriate place of feeling unthreatened, undefended. And mostly what people are threatened with in life is not saber-toothed tigers, you know, chasing you down the street. But most people are threatened, people that live under chronic feelings of fear or threat is often having to do with their ego, with their sense of self. Will other people like me? Will they reject me? Will I get what I want? And to discover a place of being unthreatened is to discover a place in the psyche, a place in the mind or in the heart, where we have nothing, very little at stake, where someone could say something or someone could like us and not like us. And, oh, it's okay. You know, we don't feel like our sense of self-worth or our own happiness is dependent on that. We don't feel crushed by many things we might feel that have to do with our ego. So part of what meditation is trying to find for us a place of well-being where we realize we're not threatenable, a place where we can't be threatened, or a place where not because we've created walls around us, but because we no longer have these buttons of being egotistical or being, you know, afraid of things that maybe we don't need to be afraid of. One of the things that deep meditation practice is meant to also help with is to come to terms with the fear of death, of dying. And when a person doesn't have fear of death, then you're kind of unthreatenable. You can go into a lot of different situations without as much fear. So to discover a place of not being unthreatenable, a place of being relaxed, at ease, open, and so you're not defended, in that place, then it's possible to have greater levels of empathy or care, or connectedness. Now, why do that? Why be interested in that? Why is developing greater empathy a useful thing? For one thing, it seems to be self-serving to do that. So that's, you know, good, right? This is wonderful what science discovers, right? More and more. And what they've discovered is that when there is a healthy expression of empathy and compassion, that the body releases oxytocin. And oxytocin is a chemical that makes people feel good. It makes mothers feel good. Oxytocin is released when they nurse. Oxytocin, I think, is released sometimes in childbirth. Oxytocin is a wonderful chemical in the body. And it seems like acts of compassion, they've been able to measure, releases oxytocin, you feel better. And however, distressed anxiety over someone else's suffering doesn't release oxytocin. Anxiety, distress over someone else's suffering, increases the heart rate. Compassionate response decreases the heart rate. So you actually become calmer, more relaxed. And I remember once traveling and going on a kind of a guided tour in the desert someplace. We were going over these kind of cliffs and this and that, hiking. And there was this woman, elderly woman, who had trouble kind of pulling herself up over these ledges. We had to pull ourselves up over and around. And it was a little bit difficult. And so I kind of stayed behind and helped her. You know, kind of lifted her up and gave her a hand and different things. And what I noticed was how much I loved helping her. I just thought it was the best feeling inside of me. This is great. And, you know, I wasn't clear after a while whether I was doing it for myself or for her, because I just felt so good. This is odd. Why am I feeling? This is really something. And then recently I read about oxytocin. I wondered whether, I was just getting a big storm of it. And so one of the ways of feeling good is to help others. And that's one of the great cardinal rules of spiritual life everywhere, is if you want to feel good, if you want to develop your spiritual life, forget about yourself and focus more on helping other people. And now we know why. it's not some mysterious thing, but at least part of it has to do with chemicals. You'll feel better if you kind of self-preoccupation probably doesn't release a lot of oxytocin. But being concerned and helpful for others is one that does it. There's often a lawyer, an attorney, that goes along with self-concern that says that self-concern is really important. You have to be concerned for yourself, and that's how you're going to get your happiness in your life. And so there's tremendous arguments, you know, in the head that keeps you involved in self-concern. But to learn to relax it to some degree and to offer yourself to others in a way, I think there's a lot of people in our society that they feel a lot more psychological health by doing that. So partly it's self-serving. But I don't like that so much. You know, you can do it just for yourself. Okay, I'm going to be really compassionate now, so do, you know, it's my own benefit. That's kind of an odd argument. I think that it's just kind of like, I think of it as a side benefit from it. Before I kind of read these kind of studies, I was quite content for myself, or talking about Buddhism to some degree, to say something like, there seems to be just in it, that's kind of partly who we are, who I am, is partly someone who responds. If they're suffering, someone's in distress, to offer to help. It's inseparable from who I am, or inseparable to the situation or to nature. It's just when I'm relaxed, what wants to come out of me, what flows, is the concern for others. And it's not premeditated, it's not doing it because it's a good idea. It's not something that's forced or imagined. It just kind of, that's what comes out, that's what happens. And not to let it flow, not to let it happen, is a kind of violence or a kind of a limitation. It's kind of like stopping something. And so the movement towards empathy and compassion, compassionate response, is not something that has to be premeditated at all. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to be told that you should do this, but rather it's something that arises naturally when the heart is open, when we're open, relaxed, and undefended. So in my own spiritual life, in my own Buddhist practice, I've noticed that as I my practice went on and on, that my heart got more and more open. And I was really surprised by that, because when I first became a Zen student, the word compassion wasn't in my active vocabulary. And I had no idea that it was something I should even want or desire. And I was really into the wisdom side of Buddhism. And then I was surprised, in retrospect, thinking back over my early years of Zen practice, that I wasn't getting any more enlightened doing Zen practice, but I was getting compassionate. And through all the difficulties and struggles that I had, that slowly it was opening and relaxing my heart. And I was developing this tremendous sense of sensitivity to the world, to others. And that sensitivity then felt like something very innate, very deep, and very integral to who I am, if we can talk about myself. And something I can't imagine, when it's there, not responding to, not living by. And I think there's many people who find that as they do some kind of spiritual practice, that spiritual practice tends to open the heart. And not to allow it to open the heart, to stay defended and frozen, is really to shortchange what's possible, the potential of a human heart. Because one of the really most beautiful things is that jewel in the lotus, that wonderful treasure that can be found in our hearts. And let that flow. And move. The mystery of empathy, the mystery of compassion. So those are my thoughts about this wonderful topic. I hope that I conveyed in this little talk the wonderfulness of it. Do you have any thoughts about it, or any comments or questions?
Yeah, it just seems that with the just from a biologic state and wondering why the chemistry part happens, having that positive feedback, the oxytocin, that's a positive adaptation for society, for community. if your body feeds you back something positive, when you have something that's helping something else, it's going to help the whole community. So it seems like biology has a good way of doing that.
Well, yeah, so part of the evolution perhaps is rather than the survival of the fittest, is the survival of the ones who had the most oxytocin. Survival of the ones who could care for each other and offer compassion. And
one small advantage or side advantage may be that when we have compassion, we get some relief from the preoccupation with our own problems.
That can be, and that sometimes can be. Sometimes it can be a danger. Sometimes that's helpful, to where compassion can relieve us kind of from our own preoccupation, our own problems. But there are some people who get addicted to helping other people as a way of avoiding their own problems. That's also possible.
So and it can become escape.
It can be an escape.
Could you give some of the hallmarks of when not getting involved is really the best activity?
Not being involved?
Yes, not reaching out, not doing something. Like, let's say, with a drug addict who's done this for quite a while, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, if it's not going to help someone, you know, if it's not going to be helpful, then don't help. Don't try to help. It's not going to be helpful. And so how is it, you know, so with a drug addict sometimes it becomes an enabling movement where you kind of are helping someone along. And sometimes some people have to reach rock bottom. It's very sad. And sometimes I've known parents of alcoholic children, for example, have to make that kind of heart-wrenching decision to just let the child go. And they become homeless and, you know, they're kind of drunk and whatever. And they realize they've tried everything they can do, but nothing's going to help. And it's almost kind of keeps them kind of coasting along in their difficult state by trying to help. And occasionally they just say, okay, let this person bottom out. And then situations I've known, the child then came back. But there's risk involved then, because sometimes they don't. You know, sometimes it doesn't help. Sometimes people are attached to being a victim. And so to treat them with compassion, you know, is kind of somehow reinforcing the victim mentality they have of poor me. And so you kind of get a sense of, you know, you have to, the consequences of trying to help someone. And hopefully we have the wisdom to see that and know when it's not appropriate. So that's what occurs to me now. It's a very important question. And maybe some other people have comments to make about when it's not appropriate to help someone who's in distress.
How do you really decide when not to help somebody? Let me, I'm a professor, I teach. If I fail somebody in a particular course, there's a probability that the person will be thrown out of the school or thrown out of the college. And you realize that when you show too much compassion, the student is not going to improve. Where do you, how do you draw the line? Is it through experience, or is it through humanity, or is it through, you know, training? Like, more lectures I attend here, the more I become lenient in the class.
More
lenient,
right? What?
I become very lenient in terms of making sure that I don't throw the student out of the program. Let's put that way.
You know, I don't have easy answers to any of this, but one of the ways of finding an answer to these kinds of questions is trying to get to know the person better. So the more you know about the person, the more you, and so it's not just your imagination about who you think they might be, then you have more information to build a case for what's best to do. And I could imagine there was some there might be occasionally, once every 10 years, for example, I don't know what, a student for whom the best thing you can do for the student is to fail the student. And the student kind of has to realize, wow, then it really wakes the person up, wow, I better get serious here. And that's really the best thing. They'll come back, you know, they'll come back to you many years later and say, the best thing you did for me in school was you failed me.
It has happened so far.
But, you know, how do you make these decisions? And, you know, sometimes it's really tough, you know, to make these big decisions for people, and they're supposed to have big consequences. You know, could have big consequences. And do we want to be responsible for these big consequences? It's a hard one. I had to fail. I taught a class at ITP once, Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, and I failed someone. And I hated doing it, you know. Just but the person hadn't done any of the work.
Well, I think there's the experience of compassion, and then when to act or be involved and when not. And I think I've watched a lot of people, including myself, get over-committed and over-involved in helping people and becoming sort of really a problem. And so I think there's a Thomas Merton quote about that I don't have memorized, but it ends with, doing too much is submitting to violence. So it's a really, tricky to balance this.
There's also a beautiful quote of someone wrote it after being in South Africa back in the apartheid times. And but anyway, there's about a story about someone finding a cocoon, seeing a butterfly trying to struggle out of a cocoon. And so the person goes along and helps the butterfly. And the butterfly falls to the ground and dies. And what the person didn't realize is that only by struggling out of the cocoon does the wings get strong enough so that the butterfly can fly. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we need to leave people, you know, to struggle too, or to make effort. So sometimes with my 7-year-old son, sometimes sometimes he wants help and he's in some kind of distress. And I try to be really present for him and say, you know, I'm here, I care about what's going on, and I'll stay with you as you try to figure it out. Sometimes. So he doesn't feel alone or abandoned, but he also realizes he can't depend on me always.
Yeah, I wanted to sort of follow up on what you were saying. I think it's interesting that we went from compassion to help, because I think they are very different things. Compassion is a state of being, and help is an action. And so it, like every action, requires skillful means. And I think that's what we're talking about in the distinction. Just like someone can feel angry, they're in a state internally of anger, but they don't necessarily act out of it. And compassion, too, I think, is a way of being that may predict certain kinds of behaviors, but doesn't prejudge action.
That's good. All right, put behind you.
The word that comes to mind is wisdom. And the Serenity Prayer in particular, which goes something like, change what you can change, accept what you can't, and have the wisdom to know the difference. So it seems to me that the connection between compassion and action is wisdom.
Wisdom, yeah, I think so. And one of the guidelines that I use a lot, I think it's very useful, is I try to pay very careful attention to my internal state, my emotional state, if I'm trying to help or have compassion. And if there's any fear or aversion in my, I'm trying to get rid of something, push something away, or if I'm out of aversion or if I'm afraid in the situation, then I think, no, I have to pay much more careful attention. Because then I'm more likely to be unwise about how I respond or act. And so rather than understanding the other person more, it's also very important to understand oneself more and really track that. One's own emotional responses are tremendously important information about our intentions and what's going on.
I think you probably answered part of my question there right now. What you were saying about compassion and getting a... I can't remember the name of the chemical.
Oxytocin.
Yeah. And then you mentioned something about that if you're anxious, like anxious and anxiety, it's the opposite. Now, if you have compassion for someone and you're feeling their pain, and it brings an anxiety to you, then that's the opposite of this chemical. And you were talking about the leaf at one time, after a while, when you even felt the pain, but now you can do it. So there's a balance that you've got to learn. Like I had, for an example, yesterday, my daughter's dog was pretty much passing away. Although we didn't know just how long, but I was sitting and being with the dog and just touching it gave me a nice feeling that I was there for him. But also it was struggling with the breathing and couldn't lie down, and watching it, I could feel that in the anxiety inside me of just part of me wanted to get away because I couldn't get away. So that was mine. This chemical, it makes you feel good, but what happens when you said about you learned when the leaf, that you now can touch leaf and you don't feel that? Is that just going through the learning and getting more wisdom?
I think there's a lot of different things that can happen in our responses to suffering in the world. I mean, one is a compassionate empathy, compassionate concern. And there's also, which often, even though it might come with some feelings of wholeness or integrity or warmth or kind of the oxytocin effect or something, it also hurts. I mean, it can be pain. Empathy sometimes comes with a sense of pain. But that's also can be distinguished from distress or anxiety. And I think it's very, I've been in situations where someone's been in tremendous suffering, and I felt, kind of like I was happening to me. And it felt really right, in a sense. It felt right it felt painful for me to be there in the room with the person. But I didn't want the person to suffer, but in a sense, it was right somehow. It just felt right. And I tried to alleviate it, or try to be helpful, but just felt right about it, even though it hurt. And there was the empathy was there, the compassion was there. But then there's, distinct from that is anxiety and distress and fear. It's often based on fear and worry. And the stronger the level of distress we have around suffering externally in the world, more often, I think, my observation, is that it has to do with unresolved emotions and feelings in ourselves. I knew someone who had a tremendous anxiety, not about people suffering, but about pet suffering, animal suffering. And when I worked with the person about this, kind of out of the charts kind of anxiety about pet suffering, it turned out the person, if I remember it right, it's many years ago now, was someone who had grown up in a war zone. And there was all this scars, internal scars, about suffering and murder and death and all these things that had happened. And somehow the symbolically, I guess, the suffering of pets was what resonated with this deep, unresolved suffering from her childhood. And so she needed to go back to this childhood trauma of what happened to her. And when she did that, then she was able to kind of not feel such horror around pets being injured or dying. So hopefully she still feels, some concern about injured or pets and stuff. But her anxiety had less to do with the pets than had to do with her own unresolved issues.
Thank you.
I think the distinction between compassion and action was a really good one, and I would just comment on the teacher question. I've just been teaching for a couple years, and I had that same thing of, oh my God, I'm going to fail this student, and they're coming and saying, oh, or not, I've never failed, but lower than they wanted, and oh, you got to do this, or I won't make the honor roll, and all this stuff, and really suffered with that. And then I started getting requests for recommendation for these folks to go to medical school, and I'm there, whoa, this person is not medical school material. And they're applying to all these medical schools, and I'm thinking of all the suffering that they're setting themselves up for, because they've never gotten the feedback that maybe this, they're this great person that could do all these great things, but medical school ain't it. And so I think, you know, I mean, for me, looking at it from the bigger picture, I could be very compassionate, and it would be the greater compassionate thing to help them understand where they could contribute in the world, instead of giving them the great grade that sends them on the wrong path that they really couldn't do.
I'll tell one last story of a friend of mine who's being trained to be a hospital chaplain. So she's doing the rounds in a hospital, doing CPE. And she said, it's been the hardest year of my life. But my supervisors love me. They think I'm the best. But they keep coming to me and saying, what they keep telling me is, you're not living up to your potential. We see that you have this great potential and you're holding back, you're shy. You know, and they keep pushing her. You have to fulfill, you know, to fulfill the potential. And that kind of stepping forward, being pushed forward, is really hard for her, kind of painful for her. But she also is valuing it. She's going to make a career out of this. So, anyway. I hope this has been useful or interesting discussion. And you might, over the next days or week, study a little bit your own responses and reactions to other people and other people's suffering and the movements inside of you of compassion, of empathy, of caring, of anxiety, and kind of study the whole complex of stuff and become more sensitive to the whole. And my belief is that the more we understand and see about how we work, the more wisdom is going to be there. Thank you.